Amanda, we're at the Centre for Alternative Technology, just watching the Cliff Railway here. What's happening?
Well, our Cliff Railway uses water power to bring visitors up the steep slate slope to get to the visitor centre. We've got two carriages on parallel railway tracks going up the hill. And as one carriage goes downhill, the other comes back uphill, and they're connected by a steel cable. And in order so that we can get enough weight to bring the visitors up the train track from the bottom, we use water by filling up a tank underneath the carriage. So once the carriage is full of people, we weigh how much water is needed, fill up the top tank, take off the brake, and the water power glides the carriage down the track, pulling the people up into the centre. It's quite an interesting and novel way to arrive.
I must say that because you get a very good view as well.
Oh, it's a beautiful view. We look out over the southern edge of Snowdonia National Park. Couldn't really ask for a nicer setting.
So all this used to be a slate quarry, did it? About, what, 30 years ago?
Well, the slate quarry ran from the end of the 19th century up until the 1950s, when it was no longer very viable to mine slate from this quarry. And then the slate quarry just went to ruin for about 20 years, up until the 1970s, when a group of people came along who were looking for a place to set up a sustainable community that was going to experiment with the new alternative technologies. Because in the 70s, people were very concerned that oil, coal and gas were running out, and that if we were going to continue a lifestyle based on energy use, we needed alternatives. Just at that time, wind was being developed, the first solar panels were around. So a group of people were really interested in these technologies, but wanted to develop them and test them so that they were as effective as they could possibly be, as well as looking at things like growing your own food, being self-sufficient. They all came together, found this beautiful spot, with the leadership of a man called Gerard Morgan Grenville, who is our founder. And 30 years on, it's the strength of the centre and the number of visitors we get is a testimony to their vision and the success.
So it must have been quite a pioneering spirit at that time, I guess.
The early days in the quarry in the 1970s, it was known as the quarry back in those days. We hear lots of stories about constant movement of slate boulders. People had to really work very hard to restore old buildings that were left from the slate mine and build new structures, plant gardens. And then once visitors came along and people showed an interest, turning it into an educational visitor centre as well. There was a lot of manpower, and in the early days, everyone was a volunteer. Thousands and thousands of person hours went into creating the centre.
Right, let's take a look at some of the displays you've got here. So we're in the self-built house, aren't we, in the conservatory, with a beautiful view over the pond that's been constructed here.
Yes, that's right. This self-build house is an example of a water seagull style self-build house, and we run several courses throughout the year showing people how to build their own houses using this timber frame technique. Now, the water seagull style is a particularly good example because it uses very simple post and beam style joints so that anybody, not necessarily a professional joiner or carpenter, can quickly master the techniques used to build a structure like this. Now, this building was put together by volunteer labour. It was built on our courses and with the help of lots of volunteers to get it finished. And it also embodies several other examples of really good sustainable building. It's south-facing. It has lots of windows facing south, such as the conservatory that we're stood in, and the windows up above that capture maximum heat and light, solar gain, so that less energy is needed to use to light and heat the building inside. And it gets a really nice temperature throughout the year. The windows are specially made so that in the summer when it gets warm in here, we can get good ventilation in. But then in the winter, we still get in heat from the sun as well. On the roof, you'll find solar water panels as well, so less energy goes into water heating because we're getting that from the sun too. And these days, it's quite fitting because this building was built by the courses here. People that come on courses at CAT get to stay here and experience what it's like to live in this kind of eco home.
We've got a theatre that we're approaching here. It's got straw bale walls, hasn't it? We've got a picture here of how it's constructed.
It's a timber frame building, and the infill walls are straw bales rendered in this beautiful, beautiful lime, which is a really breathable material. And straw bale buildings have been around in Nebraska in the States for about 100 years, but they're very recently coming over to the UK, and we're seeing more and more people using this as a distinct and very elegant building structure.
How practical would it be?
Well, there's some important things to bear in mind if you're building with straw bales, because obviously in a damp climate such as the Welsh climate where we are, you have to protect the straw from the elements. So what you do is you have, it's like if you're going out in the rain, you'd want a good hat, a good coat and Wellington boots. And that's sort of what we've got going on with the straw bales here. The hat is the roof. It's got a big overhangs to stop the driving rain getting at it. The coat is the lime render. It's nice and breathable. And then at the bottom, the Wellington boots, and we've raised the straw bales off the ground. Here we've used breeze blocks, but there's other alternatives that you could use. And that stops any damp or rot coming up from the ground. And so that way the straw bales maintain their integrity, stay strong, don't get dampened by the weather. You can see on the end of the building where we've got a display that shows you what happens if you haven't got the big overhang roof. The straw hasn't lasted as well. Inside the building, it gets used for teaching on courses and giving seminars and conferences, usually during term times. And then in the holidays, we open it up to our younger visitors. And every day we run all different activities for junior cat visitors, such as drama things, inventions. They go off on slug and bug hunts and experiment with the different sciences that we've got here as well. It's always a lot of fun if you come here in the summertime. There's a whole wealth of activity in there. It's a lot of fun too. And the straw bale theatre has just really, really helped us out with that, as it means we've got a dedicated space.
Going into the whole home house, the thing that astonishes me about this display here is the difference in energy use between an ordinary light bulb and an energy efficient light bulb.
Yeah, on the left we've got an energy efficient light bulb, and it's currently rated at around 12 watts there. Switch on the ordinary light bulb, straight up to 60 watts, and they're emitting the same amount of light. Now, if everybody in the UK replaced two of their ordinary light bulbs with two energy efficient light bulbs, the amount of electricity saved would be the same as that generated by Sizewell B nuclear power station. That's the kind of impact we could have if we all made just a tiny little change. We'd also save money because we're using less electricity, so paying less on our bills, and the efficient light bulbs have a far longer lifespan than the ordinary ones.
So I guess a lot of what the centre's about is demonstrating that the technology is already here in our lifetime to be used to be more ecological.
Absolutely. We're showing people a whole range of different things that are out there and saying this is how you can apply it to your home. Telling people a little bit about reasons why it might be a good idea to do things, but then leaving it to the individual to work out for themselves what they might do or what they could do.
Because they may not necessarily think, oh, I'm going to go and build a straw bale house or put solar panels on my roof.
I mean, that might not be the right solution either, because everybody's coming from different situations. I think it's really important that the little things that we can do, if everybody's doing the little things, it all adds up to make such a big impact.
Is there a way of gauging what impact the centre has on visitors?
Oh, we did some research last year, and we found out that something like 60 or 70% of the people that come to us then go on and incorporate that into their lives, which is a pretty big impact.
Because people also might see this centre in a beautiful countryside setting and think, ah, yeah, well, that's all very well, great, they've done the things that they do, but how do I apply it if I live in the city?
That's what we're trying to say with this particular whole home exhibition, is by showing people things that they can do wherever they're living. So we're talking about different transport options, talking about different ways that you can use energy in your home, how to conserve energy, things that are relevant to wherever you're living, in a city or a town or a rural situation like we are. We've got lots of different ways of generating electricity here at the centre. We have hydro turbines that get their power from water. We have small and large wind turbines, both down at the centre but up on the hills behind us. We also have a standby generator that runs on biodiesel, which is a fuel that comes from vegetables. And we have solar photovoltaic as well, which is solar panels that produce electricity. All these electricity sources travel to the control room, which is where we're stood right now. We've got some battery storage, but most goes into the different systems that we're looking at, and it's up to the engineers to match the electricity supplies from the different areas with the electricity demands of the buildings and residential areas that need the electricity. A recent development at CAT, because we always used to be off the grid and we were energy sufficient, But since we installed some of the larger turbines, we produce quite a surplus now. So we export the surplus onto the grid, which we sell to the national grid and make some money from. And then on any day when we weren't generating very much, rather than having to use the standby generator, we can get off the grid as well. So it's overall, we're net exporters of renewable energy. But it's good having the grid because it acts as a giant battery store. And we used to have a philosophy back in the 70s of self-sufficiency, which basically meant, you know, not having to be on the national grid, cutting yourself off, but making sure that you can cope on your own. These days, we actually believe in localization, and we don't want to cut ourselves off. We want to integrate ourselves into the local economy. So if we've got extra power, it's good that we can give that to the local community. If we've got extra vegetables growing in the gardens, it's good that they're not just enjoyed by us and left to waste if we do too much, that it goes locally as well. And equally, we can buy in things that we don't need in a local trade scheme. Now today it's quite hot. It's according to this, it's metal panel that's been out in the sun has reached 33 degrees. But you could get that even hotter just through very simple solar technology. Paint it black, black absorbs heat. It's like wearing a black t-shirt on a hot day. It really feels warm. And you're ready, it's 15 degrees hotter. It's almost 50 degrees. Now insulate behind the panel. So we've got the black painted panel with insulation underneath it. That stops heat escaping out the back. We've got another 5 degrees, so we're now at 55 degrees. Finally, put a perspex or glass layer on the top. What that means is that the light and heat can pass through one way, but the heat can't escape back the other way. It's like having a greenhouse effect. And the panel underneath, which is the same panel but painted black, insulated, with the perspex panel on top, almost too hot to touch, 67 degrees. That's doubled in temperature from the original 33, just thanks to a few very simple basic modifications. Over the course of a year, we found people with solar water heating panels on the roof can get about half their hot water just off that. So that's a huge saving on the energy bill for their house. But also a really good way of knowing that you're cutting down your contribution to climate change.
I guess people think, though, it'd be expensive to install.
Yeah, they certainly are. They're not cheap to install. If you get a professionally installed solar water heating system, you're looking at an investment of several thousand pounds. The good news at the moment, though, is that the British government has grants called Clear Skies grants for householders to put professionally installed solar water heating systems on their rooftops, and you can get up to 50% of the costs covered from a government grant. That cuts the payback time to possibly as low as 5 years in terms of the reduced bill paying off your investment. It's well worthwhile. But if you don't want to invest lots of money, but you still really, really want solar water heating panels, there's another solution for a DIY enthusiast. And that's these ones here.
Old radiators.
Yep. Same principle, old radiator painted black, insulated underneath, glass panel on front, put in a cold frame. Obviously not as it's not going to be as efficient as the professional system, but way cheaper. You could do something like this probably for around £70. Or the next step up would be to buy these things, which are called clip fins. They're just slightly rather more effective than the radiators. Then you're looking at investment of £100 or so into this panel here. Now we're actually stood in the solar area of the centre, the solar photovoltaic. There's several different types of solar energy, and this one is one that generates electricity. We're stood in front of a nice, beautiful fish pond, which has an interesting fountain powered by a solar panel. Up at the top, we've got a huge solar photovoltaic roof.
That's a large roof, isn't it?
Yeah, when it was built, which was about 15 years ago now, it was the largest in the UK. But luckily, solar technology's taken off, and there are many bigger than this now. Now, one of the issues with solar is that it generates a lot of electricity during the day, but most people need their electricity in the evening. So unless you're going to have very big batteries, it might not be the best technology. That's why we put our large solar roof on top of an office, because underneath there, the electricity need is great in the day when you want computers, printers, and lighting. So the electricity from the roof above can power the office underneath, and it's a really, really good match without having to have such big batteries.
What about in the wintertime?
In the wintertime, we still do get some solar power, but it's obviously the peak production time is in the summer when the days are much longer. You don't even need direct sunlight to generate from solar power. You just need a good south-facing aspect to put the solar panels on. I've been in a valley in Wales. We probably wouldn't recommend a solar roof as the ideal solution. But here at the centre, we want to show people what the options are wherever they're located. And certain parts of the country, solar is a really good thing to have.
So we've got a roof here that's got grass and moss and all sorts of other things growing.
Yeah, this building is our food store. So we just saw Dave the chef taking some food in there. Got really thick slate walls, big thermal mass, and it stays really cool. Now the green roof that we've got on top is not so much there for insulation or anything like that, but it really, really encourages wildlife and biodiversity. You can actually see we've got bumblebees in there, all kinds of different plants have self-seeded into the grass turf section, and we've also got the sedum option, which is something that's become quite fashionable in green roofs recently, to show the two different styles. A green roof is a great idea, particularly in cities, to kind of reclaim green space in urban areas.
So next to the store that we were just talking about, there's a beautiful little garden here, isn't there?
Yeah, this is a Mavamwe's garden, and it's a very small space. It's the equivalent to a backyard that you might have if you lived in a city, in an urban area. And you can see how Mavamwe, she grows lots of food, and she does this in containers. You can see in the corner here, she's got her compost bin, and she's also got a water butt to collect rainwater off her roof. And then she's got lots of different beds made out of old containers, out of pallet wood, out of bricks, and each bed is growing different types of vegetables for her. So we've got some beans growing over there, some nasturtiums over there, which are actually a fantastic spinach substitute. I think we've got some onions and garlic in here, celery over here, strawberries, and a fantastic vine up here. It shows you how much you can grow in a really, really small space, and how much of your own food you can provide, even if you've only got a backyard.
You know, looking at it as well, there's a lot flowering here, isn't there?
That's right. We've got a lot of really bright flowers in here, and several good reasons for that. We practice companion planting here. There are certain plants that grow really well together if planted side by side, but also bright flowers attract pollinating insects so that we can save some seeds for next year's growth as well.
Hello.
We just met Errol, who's been doing the gardens here for about 10 years, I think.
It is hard work, but in that hard work, it's very, very enjoyable, and I wouldn't have it any other way. It's not easy, but the best things I don't think are easy. And I don't know, somehow a battle with nature is far, far more pleasant than a battle with man.
Really got a good natural balance.
Yes, it really works.
It's
difficult to maintain. You realise as well how much compost, how much you do need to feed soil if you're feeding yourself. And how important it is to recycle and compost and carry on, that you can't just keep taking from the soil, because within about a year or two, when you've cropped vegetables, they decrease in quantity and quality quite significantly without adding compost.
We've done a huge amount of research in composting in recent years. Traditionally, composting has been the preserve of allotment gardeners who put a lot of hours and a lot of energy into making the perfect compost to go on their allotment plot. That's brilliant. But we're also really aware that a lot of householders are putting food scraps just into their bin that goes to landfill. And that's really bad, because in landfill, when the food degrades, it gives off methane, which is a really bad climate change gas. It's one of the worst. So what we wanted to do was to develop a composting method that was easy to use, that was not labour intensive, so that somebody who cooks with vegetables in their kitchen can compost too, get great compost for their garden without having to go to all the trouble of several hours of turning their compost heap every week. And this is what we came up with, the cool composting method, or the high fibre composting method. Basically, by taking food scraps and non-recyclable cardboard and paper, such as egg boxes, cereal packets, toilet roll liners, combine them together with the food scraps, you get just by leaving it alone, you get a really, really good compost. So we've worked to develop a compost caddy that would go in the kitchen. You could even line it if you didn't like the mess that you sometimes get. You sometimes get a bit of a bad smell in a compost bin. Line it with one of these degradable starch bags that goes in the compost heap too. When you filled it up, just take the whole thing and stick it on your compost heap, and then just leave it alone, and a year to a year and a half later, fabulous compost for your garden.
So it's not just the food scraps going in there, it's the cardboard and other combustibles as
well. That's right. In order to make good compost, you really need two elements. You need nitrogen, and that comes from the breaking down of the food scraps, but you also need carbon. So that's what you get from the cardboard. And the other good thing that the cardboard does is, because we're using bulkier cardboard like the egg boxes, it gives a structure to the compost heap, which creates spaces in the compost bin for all the little critters, you know, the worms and the springtails and all the things that come in and do the composting, to get in, and little habitats for them. So it's actually a really vital ingredient. When you ask people to think of the animal kingdom, they tend to come up with, you know, cats and dogs, or bears and tigers, large animals. But actually, if you were to look at all the different species that make up the animal kingdom, the vast majority are actually living in the soil, insects and things smaller than that. So this display is all about opening people's minds up to what goes on in the soil. It's not just an inanimate object, it's actually full of life. Now, as we go into the molehole, which is named after Megan, the molehole owner, we're going to shrink, and each window we look at, imagine you've shrunk another, so first of all 50 times and then 500 times, and you'll see what creatures you'd be face to face with in the soil. These are some of the creatures that you can still see with the naked eye, that these are the things that you might find if you look into your compost bin and see breaking up the food scraps into compost. Mm. Got worms and beetles and wood lice, but they're rather large now that we've shrunk. Now, shrinking even more so that we're 500 times smaller, these are the little rotters. They create rotting. We've got springtails, mites, and a couple of spores in the background.
Look like crabs, don't they?
Oh, they do when they're this big. This display looks at the enemy of all gardeners, the slug, and different techniques that you can employ to control slugs in your garden. And we had a big competition called Bug the Slug, where we asked all our supporters to write in with what techniques they use to control slugs. Quite interesting responses, so many in fact that we published a book called The Little Book of Slugs. Mm. And here's a few of them. Now, the one that our gardener Roger swears by the most is regular hoeing, as he believes that slugs don't like to cross disturbed ground. But other things you can use are things like beer traps. You can plant things like comfrey or marigolds so that the slugs go for your marigolds and not your cabbages. Some people swear by decoys, models of badgers, and I'm not convinced of that one myself, but you know, if it works for you. I mean, our advice generally to people is go for several different methods. But regularly review them.
And all pesticide free, obviously.
Oh, of course. There's lots of different displays here demonstrating different compost bins, different things you can compost. But here we've got our sampler showing everything that we compost here. So on the left we've got the high fibre household compost, that's the vegetable scraps and cardboard that we talked through earlier. Next to that, leaf mould. It takes slightly longer to compost, but you get a really, really rich soil that's brilliant for potting. We get a lot of inquiries about how to compost grass. A lot of people find that it goes very slimy in their compost bin, gives off a nasty stench and doesn't actually compost. The solution we found, which works for us, was adding paper towels. Obviously, because we're a visitor centre, we get a lot of paper hand towels left over. I mean, this solution would work really well for schools or somewhere that had paper towels and grass clippings together. Put them together, you've got that nitrogen and carbon mixture. And again, great compost.
How long does it take to get to the compost?
For the grass and paper towels, we're looking at about 18 months. The leaf mould is a few years, is looking at more like 3 years. High fibre is a year and a half. It depends on the material, really. Going along the sampler, we've got this is cardboard and urine. I'm not going to stick my hand in that one, but happy to do it in the finished one. woody waste, and this takes quite a lot of years, but does eventually break down. And then finally, human waste. We're off the main sewage system here, so we use compost toilets and we use rebed sewage systems as a way of avoiding having to connect up and produce a lot of sewage. Here we've got, after 1 year you can see it's really starting to break down, and after 2 years, compost from human waste is perfectly safe for me to handle and pick up and play with. You want to stick your hand in it? Oh, well done.
Doesn't smell at all.
Now, we're constantly putting in new displays here and showing new up-to-date technologies. So you can see we're in the development end of the centre. Over on the left, we've got some people working on a timber frame building. Got some very noisy children exploring the recycled instruments section over there.
And you've got an old turbine over here.
That's right. This is the where the new energy displays come in. We've got a second-hand wind turbine. Like, wind power is something that's really interesting. Back in the 1980s, we put the first wind turbine on a Welsh hillside. Today in the UK, there's something like 1,500 wind turbines generating electricity. Wind farms are getting more and more powerful, and government support is really behind them now. We've seen commitments to, in here in Wales, 10% renewable energy by 2010, coming initially from wind power, also looking at hydropower as well. It's really positive to see people embracing these technologies and making full-on commitments to them.
And talking of hydropower?
Yep, we're at the hydro turbine. Now, I'm going to stop here, or else you won't be able to hear my voice because it's so noisy in there. Now, You wouldn't know it today because it's scorching hot, but we have a huge water resource here. We get a lot of rain and we use it in lots of different ways. At the top of the centre, there's actually a reservoir that came from the slate mine that was used for power in those days. That reservoir at the top is a store of water for us. We also use it for recreation. I'm sure there are probably people swimming up there in there today as well. But from there, the water travels down a pipe where, first of all, some water gets taken off to get treated as drinking water through slow sand filters and ultraviolet filters. And then other water comes down a really fast, steep pipe and comes out at this Pelton wheel, which is a hydro turbine. And there it's used to generate electricity, which is used all over the centre. From here, it goes on into the lake, where it's a fantastic habitat for very, very large carp, for ducks, and all kinds of other wildlife. And then from the lake, it goes to the railway, which is how you arrived at the centre. So that's a lot of different uses from the same water. Other water gets taken off at this point and used to flush the toilets next to the railway. Then they go through a reed bed sewage system. And finally, the water's returned to the stream that it originally flowed from at the bottom of the centre. An environment agency always tested and are very happy with it, so we're doing a good job with it.
And following the water, I descended down the Cliff Railway with thanks to Amanda Roll Pickering at the Centre for Alternative Technology. If you'd like to follow up any of the ideas you've heard about, you can visit them, of course, in person or at their website at cat.org.uk.